This episode is brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back, with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
A crew from the Canby Fire District returned home Monday after being deployed to assist in the response to the sprawling Mosier Creek Fire in Central Oregon last week. The unit was led by Captain Jason Wayner and also included Engine Boss Brad Frank and Firefighter Bo Ramos. Division Chief Matt English told the Canby Now podcast Friday that the crew was serving at the head of the fire and was doing well. The Mosier Creek Fire caused thousands to evacuate and eventually spread to almost 1,000 acres in Wasco County. But the conflagration was considered at least 65% contained as of Monday. And fire officials report that all the Oregon State Fire Marshal's remaining Structural Protection Task Force and Incident Management Team will demobilize and head back to their local jurisdictions later that day. Division Chief English said the district was glad to have their crew back home and appreciates all the hard work they put in. Canby Fire had a busy weekend in their absence, including two simultaneous cardiac episodes on Sunday and an attempted water rescue on the Pudding River near Arndt Road that afternoon, which sadly resulted in the drowning of a middle-aged woman. English said the woman was found by a family member and the circumstances prior to her discovery are unknown. The victim's name has not been released. Paramedics with CFD and mutual aid agencies attempted all possible resuscitation and advanced life support measures, but to no avail.
The city of Canby has a frontrunner in its search for a new city administrator following a series of panel interviews Tuesday, a meet-and-greet event at Waite Park, and a closed-door session held late that evening. Interim city administrator Amanda Zyber said councilors came to a consensus in the executive session and plan to make an announcement at Wednesday night's regularly scheduled meeting. The frontrunner will receive a conditional job offer contingent upon successful completion of a background check conducted by a third-party investigator. His name will not be announced until the background process is completed, Zyber said. The background check is fairly extensive and is expected to take about 3 weeks, followed by contract negotiation. Zyber, who had previously announced she would be stepping down from her position with the city as of September 1st, said she has agreed to stay on until the new city administrator is on board, which she anticipates will take about 6 weeks. On Tuesday night, Mayor Brian Hodgson introduced the three finalists, Scott Archer, Brian Bosshart, and Randy Robertson, and asked them to share a little bit about themselves from the gazebo, as well as answer two questions, their most embarrassing moment, and how to preserve Canby's small-town charm in the midst of its continuing growth. After being allowed to speak for 10 minutes each, the trio assumed their positions throughout the park and met with those in attendance, answering questions and explaining how they would fulfill the role of Canby's chief executive if given the chance. One of the three will be asked to lead the city through its economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, the continued growth in Canby's housing index and industrial park, and the numerous retirements or departures that have left the city with new people or vacancies in many key positions, including public works, transit, the library, planning, human resources, and assistant city administrator. For more information on the three candidates' bios, as well as their remarks at Tuesday night's event, find this story on our website, canbynowpod.com.
With the filing deadline looming for the already crowded Canby City Council race, a sixth candidate has thrown his hat into the ring, Jordan Tibbles. Tibbles is a Marine veteran who works in trading grains and commodities. He holds a bachelor's degree in business administration from Oregon State University. Earlier this summer, he organized and spoke at a pro-police event supporting first responders at Waite Park. He also participated in a similar flag-waving demonstration with current Canby City Councilor Sean Varwig on the Interstate 5 overpass at the Canby-Charbonneau exit several weeks later. In March, he spoke at a Canby City Council meeting discussing a requested local proclamation for Transgender Day of Visibility. Tibbles called for instead a Canby Unity Day, where all citizens of Canby are celebrated. Tibbles joined a field of candidates that includes Council President Tim Dale and current councilors Tracy Hensley and Sarah Spoon, along with newcomers James Hibb and Jason Padden. A fourth incumbent, Trig Berg, has not yet filed to keep his seat. Incumbent Mayor Brian Hodson, who is the executive director of an Avamere senior care facility, has also filed to seek a fifth term in office with no challenges as of yet. The former city councilor has not drawn an opponent since he first won the position from the one-term incumbent Randy Carson in 2012. Councilors serve four-year terms, with their expiration dates alternating such that three of them normally open every 2 years. The fourth seat in this election is the result of former Councilor Tracy Heights' resignation last year. Trig Berg was appointed to replace her, but per the city charter, this appointment was only until the next city election, not the full unexpired term. Councilors are elected at large, meaning the top three vote getters, or in this case, the top four, will win the open seats. In this case, the candidate with the fourth most votes will serve only the remaining 2 years of Height's original term. The mayor of Canby serves only a 2-year term. All city officials are nonpartisan. Qualified candidates for city council or mayor must have lived within the city limits of Canby for at least 12 months and be a registered voter. Filing will be open until 5 p.m. Thursday, August 20th.
The Canby Fire District is seeking a renewal of its current operating levy in the upcoming November 3rd general election. The Board of Directors is asking for the public's approval at the same rate currently in effect, 45 cents per $1,000 of assessed valuation. 5 years ago, the citizens of Canby and Barlow strongly supported the district's request to increase the 5-year local option levy from 34 cents to its current rate. In response, the district has met and even exceeded what they promised they would do to improve local fire and emergency medical services, including staffing a second medic unit 24 hours a day. Their original goal had been to staff a second medic only for the 12 hours each day that the Canby Fire District volunteers were not available. Canby Fire District firefighters and medics responded to 2,998 calls for service last year, according to Fire Chief Jim Davis, Davis says funds from the local option levy will allow the district to maintain 6 firefighter EMTs and all current staff positions. The fire district experiences 2 emergency calls simultaneously over 38% of the time, Chief Davis said. Without the current staffing for the second medic unit, the ambulance would have to be dispatched from Wilsonville, Oregon City, or Oak Grove. For a typical property assessed at $250,000, the annual cost would be approximately $112 a year, or about $10 a month. If the local option levy is not renewed, the existing levy would expire in 2021.
Folks itching for some drive-in fun at the fairgrounds this summer will have to wait a little longer. The Clackamas County Fairgrounds hoped to open its new drive-in movie theater, Fairground Features, this Friday, but it was not to be. Fairgrounds Marketing and Vendor Coordinator Tyler Nizier reported that the holdup is due to a delay in shipping for the component that is pretty crucial to the operations of the theater, the screen. "We're having some issues with getting the screen here," said Nizier, who had stressed earlier this month that the August 21st opening date was very tentative and depended on all the stars aligning. "It's just taking longer than expected to get shipped." The drive-in will instead open to the public on Friday, August 28th. Hopefully. The fairgrounds had hoped to build a permanent drive-in theater this summer in the yellow lot of the property's northwest corner, which would accommodate an estimated 400 visitors. But the lost revenue from the many canceled events forced them to pivot to a temporary model while they built the revenue and support. "It just turns out it takes a lot of cement to hold a piece of metal way up in the sky and keep it from falling on people and hurting them," Canby City Councilor Greg Parker, who's also a member of the fair board, said in early August. "The staff did the best it could. Now we're going to have to do a switcheroo, and hopefully within the next month, we'll be getting some movies going on out there." The fairgrounds is working with Canby Cinema to procure the movies to be shown. Nizier said the drive-in will show new movies as soon as they can, but the Hollywood screening calendar has, of course, been wrecked by the coronavirus this summer, and new releases keep getting pushed back. "As soon as we're able to play new runs, we will be playing new runs," he said. One more thing that is coming to the fairground soon: a taste of the fair food court in the red lot, which is located outside of the fence on the other side of the fairgrounds. Open to both the public and drive-in audiences, the area will feature vendors from past Clackamas County fairs served via modified drive-thru. Movie theater concessions, popcorn, soda, etc. will also be offered at the drive-in. Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't, like, more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows, you know?
No. I mean, like, transparent as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah. Which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers. And they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop to learn more today.
Joining us on the Canby conversation today is Cooper Fitch. He is a Portland area filmmaker and writer and a Canby High School graduate. And when we're recording this, Cooper is actually out in the Eastern Oregon area and preparing to participate in the Oregon Short Film Festival this week, which is taking place in the Dalles. Hi, Cooper.
Hey, how are you doing? Well, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Like we mentioned, we got the Short Film Fest coming up this week, and you have a project that has won an award there and is going to be screened tomorrow when we're recording this. But tell us just a little bit about the festival, and it's happening, obviously, in a location that is not the normal place for it or the normal way that it's set up. I don't know if you've been there in the past to this festival, but it's normally in Portland.
Yeah, normally it's the Oregon Short Film Festival, and normally it happens in downtown Portland. But with the coronavirus pandemic, they decided to do it at a drive-in, which I think is a great idea, and it should be cool to see the movie up there. I actually did submit the script for this film 2 years ago and won the Best Oregon Screenplay. So it's kind of funny to come around and win Best Oregon Film for the film.
That's awesome. So it kind of came full circle in that way.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I've been in contact with the festival director, so it's been he's been very supportive in getting this film out there.
That's awesome to see that come to fruition in that way. It's got to be really cool. Obviously, it hasn't happened yet, but I imagine you must be pretty psyched to be able to see your work on a huge screen like that at a drive-in style.
Yeah, it's cool. I've never seen it on we've only played it once, actually, at a private screening when
Oh, really?
We finished the movie for friends and family. So it'll be cool to see it again.
Yeah.
On the drive-in.
Yeah, you've been keeping it pretty close to the vest. You sent me, and we were really, really grateful to be able to watch it, a really top secret, like private version, so I could watch it and sound somewhat intelligent as we're talking about it. But is that because you have sort of a plan for the release for how you want to get it out there, or what?
Not necessarily. It's really most of the film festivals are they don't want you to release it to the public, so that if they do choose it, your film is like one of the premier screenings of it, even or one of the first screenings of it. So
gotcha.
The way the festival circuit works is it ends up taking at least a year by the time you finish the film to, like, you know, get into festivals and have them actually play. So this weird limbo period where you have it done, but you can't really release it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's really different than how we operate with, like, the podcast and the local news, where we write it and then, like, 5 seconds later we're able to put it out to people.
But up right away.
Yeah, get that instant validation, whereas you're waiting on pins and needles, like, hoping people like it. But like you say, you get to share it with friends and family and get that feedback.
Yeah, it's nice. I've shared it to a few people, but, you know, I just, it's one of those things. You just, I want to get it out there as much as anyone, but
sure.
I've got to follow the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Cooper, can you tell us a little bit about your career up to this point and how you got into filmmaking?
Yeah, so I whitewater kayak, and that's kind of how I got into making videos, is I would make GoPro videos for that, and I ended up getting a sponsor when I was 17, and so started making more videos, and then decided I wanted to do narrative stuff. I had always wanted to write and found screenplays were kind of really clicked with me. And so I took a break from school and kind of shifted focus. And then my first, like, opportunity in the business was I actually got an internship on Portlandia four or five years ago now.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it was very cool. It was a great opportunity. I actually got a surfing through kayaking, and then I ended up doing that, and then I did a short film one weekend, and got a job on this Netflix show, Everything Sucks, which was my first paying gig in the industry. So
awesome. Well, Everything Sucks, what is that about? Sounds funny.
Yeah, it only ran for one season, unfortunately, but it was a Netflix show about kids in boring Oregon in the 90s. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can kind of guess what that would be like, you know, being a 90s kid myself, not growing up in Oregon, but growing up in a small town. I can foresee some of the fun antics.
Yeah, it's kind of a teen teen comedy, you know, so it was cool. But yeah, so I started working in the industry pretty regularly, you know, while I was finishing school, and wanted to make my own stuff. And so I started at first just making a really short, simple thing, a simple little movie with a couple of friends. And then over the years, I've kind of evolved. And as my network has grown in the industry, I've been able to bring people in. And, you know, Macy's Parade was kind of, it's the first movie I think my, got my skills kind of coalesced into something I'm pretty proud of. So
yeah, you should be,
you know, I'm excited for it to come out and for people to see it. And, you know, I want to keep making movies, and, it's been a blast.
Yeah.
Over the last
You've had like the coolest life so far. Like, I'm so jealous. Oh yeah. I was a sponsored whitewater kayaker, and that's how I learned how to do film. And then I got jobs in it. I'm sure it's that easy.
You know,
it's always that easy to get into the industry, right?
Yeah. It's kind of a weird industry. There's no direct route. It's not like you apply and then you get a job, you know. It's all gig based. So
right.
I still work in the industry in between making my own movies, doing freelance gigs mostly.
Yeah.
Mostly on movies and TV, but in the last year or so, I started doing more commercial work. I was a producer at an ad agency for a few months, and then do some commercials here and there just to, you know, pay the bills or whatever. But it's a cool lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to have found my way.
Your freelance gigs that you do, are they mostly directing or writing or what?
No, I've kind of been working my way up. I started as a PA, obviously, which pretty much everyone does, and then I worked my way up to where I was an assistant production coordinator, and then eventually production coordinator and producer on smaller stuff. And then I have assistant directed some commercials and things, but it's kind of, I mostly work as a crew person and then make stuff on my own, and trying to get to the point where, I can direct full time.
Sure. Yeah. The PA, what are they? Is that sort of like the coffee guy?
Yeah. It's basically the production assistant. You know, you go carry the chairs, go get the director coffee, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit about Macy's Parade. Like you said, it's been this 2 year long, kind of labor of love, side project. You mentioned it's something that you're really proud of. Can you tell us a little bit about, for folks that haven't seen it, which I'm going to guess is most people. Tell us a little bit about kind of the basic storyline and what you were trying to tell, or kind of what you were hoping to bring, out of this project.
Yeah. So it's a family drama set at Christmas that centers around Macy, who's the matriarch of this suburban family.
Yeah, and in your answer, and Cooper, I also want you to explain to the people how you were able to know exactly what my Christmases look like every year.
They're exactly what my Christmases look like.
Oh,
so,
okay. Well, there you go.
It's funny. I was thinking about it. Usually when I make something, it kind of just starts as I'm thinking about something that happened in my real life, and then it kind of spirals and eventually turns into a fictional approximation. And so basically I wanted to this. I really like the idea of the kind of dysfunctional family movies, like Agatha Osage County. I liked the idea of centering around this family matriarch, Macy, who basically throughout the film, you know, she's trying to present this perfect evening for her family at Christmas, and everything kind of systematically falls apart. And that idea of like the head of the household as being the woman in this case, you know, trying to just keep everything together, and like her plight and that, how that weighs on her and how she pushes it down, you know, and isn't able to, isn't fully appreciated, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And you, I mean, you said that you draw from your own life. Do you have like your poor mother or somebody to your poor grandmother to draw in for poor Macy?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny. I think my grandparents knew it was loosely based off them. And
yeah,
we actually shot at my grandparents' house. So it's all like I shot it knowing like exactly where we had previous Christmases. We shot the scenes, you know, in the same exact room, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
But they were all very gracious about it. And, you know, obviously it's not them. I'm not that autobiographical, but they're definitely pieces.
Yeah. Did you say you shot this at your grandparents' house?
Yeah. At my grandparents' house in Wilsonville, actually.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. It's a really neat space, and you do some really cool shots. Like, obviously, a lot of it takes place inside, but there's one shot I really liked where you see one of the, the husband of one of the characters kind of walking through the entire house, and the camera's outside, and you kind of follow him through the windows and stuff.
Yeah. I've had a lot of people comment on that. I like that shot too. I wish we had, done more of it, but we're kind of dollying along, following him from outside, and you get this kind of outside looking in perspective of a voyeur kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned how your career has kind of helped you, your clout and your profile has kind of raised over the years with the different jobs that you've been able to take. But you had professional actress and some really great actors in this cast that really brought it to life.
Yeah, totally. I, especially with this one, I tend to write a lot of, relationship drama with ensembles. And so I wanted really good acting because it's not action packed. It's all about their interactions. And I felt like if any of the pieces were bad, it wasn't going to be believable. So we casted SAG. So it's through the union. They're all professional actors.
Yeah.
You know, that's expensive, but I think it's worth it, to get good performances.
Yeah, yeah. And the lead, the actress who played Macy, was actually nominated through the Oregon Short Film Festival as well for Best Actress.
Yeah, Lynn American. Cool. She's fantastic. I've been talking to her over the past week or two about the nomination, and I was kind of bummed she didn't win, but she is fantastic in the film.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It is, you mentioned obviously how it's not action-packed and whatnot, but you do such a good job because, it's so relatable, and some of the little things that happen, and I won't give too much away, but, one of the families is late, and everyone's, waiting for them to eat dinner, and then they get there, and the family had, of course, already eaten dinner and had, stopped on the way, which happens so much, and it's, such a small thing, in that moment it's it's so infuriating, and you really do such a great job of bringing that out in this short film.
Oh, thank you. I say it's not action packed, but I try to keep it as tight as possible, and I edit all my movies too, so just because it's mostly character interactions and dialogue. I mean, and there's some, it's not to say that they're just standing around talking, but, there is a lot of dynamics there and little things that, hopefully, like you said, invoke that feeling of frustration in the audience.
No, I mean, I won't give it away, but there's a couple of scenes that even involve what had to be some type of stunt work.
yeah, it was, we did, at the end, there's a fall in the, it was, we shot the, so we had kids in this too, there's two kids that are in the film, and we cast them just like everyone else, but the thing is, since we were on a SAG contract, the Screen Actors Guild, along with the Oregon Labor Department, kids can only work 8 hours a day, So we had to schedule to try to figure out how to shoot all of their scenes without, running overtime because we don't want to get in trouble.
Right.
And so, that it came together really well, but that kind of stunt scene at the end, it all happened really quickly because the clock was ticking and we were running out of time with the kids. So.
Well, and you're outside. Right, and it's it's dark. It had to have been nighttime at that point.
So we shot this like little beginning of last June, So it was kind of one of those things where we have a couple of outside scenes and you have to wait until it gets dark. So that goes down to like scheduling. And
yeah,
my friend Danica, who's a great producer in her own right, came on at the last second to help to be our assistant director. And she did a fantastic job of, you know, helping me tighten up the schedule and making the set run.
Yeah, that's so funny. Especially like with it being June, obviously I had to wait even a lot later for it to get dark. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
the one actress, one of the younger actresses, not the kids, but playing one of the daughters, who is not wearing a coat in any of the outside scenes, and I felt so bad for her. And now I realize, oh, that was silly.
Yeah. It was probably like 80 degrees, but they're good actresses. They
yeah, cold, yeah, no, but... she really sold it.
That's funny.
Yeah. In the last couple minutes we have, Cooper, I'd love to hear just a little bit more kind of about the filmmaking process. Like, what was it like kind of working with the actors and actresses for something like this, where it is, you know, probably very easy for them to draw, you know, from some of their own experiences? What did they kind of think of this project and the process? Yeah.
I got a lot of great feedback when my casting director, Rachel Mossy, she was great, and she sent it out to the agents in town, and then we did casting, and everybody was very excited because, yeah, their characters are so relatable. A lot of them could definitely pull from their own lives, and basically what I did is when I finally had everyone cast, I sent them some movies to watch. We didn't have really a lot of money or time to do a proper rehearsal, but that's what we did in pre-production. And then on set, really, it's as far as I feel like I got on this film, I felt very confident about being on set and directing and knowing how to you know, talk to actors and everything. And basically it's kind of a give and take. We do usually a few blocking rehearsals so they know where to sit, where to walk, where to set that cup down, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's just kind of a process of letting them do their thing. And obviously they have an idea in their head of what it's supposed to be. And I have an idea of what I want it to be. And then it's just kind of, you know, shaping it a little bit at a time towards what I want. And usually it's kind of a fine balance because you don't want to, you know, overload them with information and it's really not going to be helpful if you do that. So,
right. Because you want it to be fluid and natural where they don't, you know, you can't tell that they're thinking, okay, I'm going to do this next and I'm going to do this next. And now I'm going to do this. Yeah.
Totally. So yeah, I think clear communication is really important. And we try to like, you know, making movies is a stressful prospect in any situation, but you know, try to have fun and, you know, everyone, I thought the crew was great and we had a really good time shooting it. So,
Yeah. Really cool. Well, what's next for you? Can you tell us anything?
Yeah. So I have a script, that I've been working on, called The Dinner Party, which is actually based on a feature film I wrote a while back. And, I'm really excited to make it. It's every project I've made has kind of been a step up, and this one will be bigger and has more stunts and more involved production and more shooting days and pretty much bigger in every ride.
More awkward, cringeworthy moments.
yeah, definitely. I have a script for that, and I've met with the producer, and I'll produce it too. But my friend Danica, who I mentioned. And Jason, who shot Macy's Parade, is going to shoot this one, too.
Awesome.
He's a fantastic DP. He actually works mostly on commercials for Wieden and Kennedy and other agencies. But we're kind of in the beginning of it. I have some money saved, and I want to start shooting, but it's kind of tricky now with COVID, and I need to save a little more money. But I think we're shooting for next spring or early summer is hopefully when we're going to be able to do it. So
yeah, you got to have extra money to CGI out all the masks that the actors have to wear, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah. I don't know if I have that kind of money, but...
Yeah, I don't know. You might have to save up for a while. Well, Cooper, it has been such a delight to talk to you. Huge congratulations on all your success just to this point in your career. I'm sure there's much more to come. We'll look forward to watching it as you progress. And when Macy's Parade is able to go out to people, definitely let us know so we can share that link and let people watch it.
Yeah, I will. I'll definitely send it over. And thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Stay cool and try to avoid fires out there in Central Oregon, man.
Yeah, I will.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Canby Then is brought to you by The Book Nook, Canby's amazing local bookstore and gift shop. Your source for new and used books, comic books, audiobooks, vintage books, and you get the idea. All things books, across from the Backstop in downtown Canby. This week, we're continuing our look back at the history of our wonderful Clackamas County Fair to, you know, distract ourselves from the fact that we'd probably be at the fair right now, if not for the coronavirus pandemic. Streets came to the Clackamas County Fairgrounds in 1911, just in time for the 5th annual county fair. A new road was built from the rail line to the heart of the fairgrounds, and a grand archway was also designed for the entrance. Smaller streets were laid out for the grounds themselves, and a restaurant was to be installed at the grandstand. A force of men was dispatched in August. In those days, the fair was held in late September or early October to effect the improvements. The increased infrastructure was needed as the Clackamas County Fair continued to grow in its reputation as one of the young state's premier events. More persons have announced their intentions of camping on the grounds this year than ever before, the Oregonian reported in 1911, and the fair promises to be the most successful ever held. Arrangements have been made for 2 special trains to be run to the fair daily from Oregon City. Organizers hoped for the fair's success in 1911 rested on the slew of new attractions they had planned. A Scottish theme was lent to several of the events that year, including a troupe of beautiful dancing girls in Highland costumes, bagpipe music, and tug-of-war contests, the highlight of which was a grudge match between a team of city slickers from Oregon City against a group of county boys from Molalla. Commerce in Oregon City practically shut down during the fair. Almost the entire population was over in Canby, according to the Oregonian. And another headlining attraction was a mock battle between the National Guard units of Woodburn and OC. Every school in the county contributed athletes to a track meet on the fair's final day, while Charles Hoyt, said to be the only newspaper reporter in Oregon who owns an automobile, I know the feeling, and Oregon City car dealer Chester Elliott held an honest-to-goodness drag race in their, quote, big cars. Though it would be decades before the Canby Rodeo was officially founded, Bronco busting was also brought to the fairgrounds for the first time in 1911. The fair was indeed a smashing success, as expected. Scandal would descend upon the event soon after, however, when George Lazelle, a breeder of fine cows from Mount Pleasant, discovered why his prized bovine did not take first place in the milk contest. The cow was milked by a mischievous person the morning of the contest, the Oregonian later declared. Mr. Lazelle was positive before the contest that his animal would win the blue ribbon, and when the judges announced the awards and his entry was not even mentioned, he was dumbfounded. A quiet investigation was made the following week, and Lazelle had soon snuffed out the trick, if not the culprit. He does not know whether the person who milked the cow was in collusion with any other entrants, the newspaper said. One can only assume the poor man had a cow. Canby's globetrotting ambitions continued in 1912 with plans for German-themed festivities, though these were nearly derailed by the geopolitical turmoil that we now recognize as the run-up to World War I. Our usual German day at the festival at the Clackamas County Fair will not be celebrated this year. Neither will we observe our annual Volksfest, Gustav Schnurr announced in a statement that September. Be it therefore understood when we visit our county fair, as we all should do, that we will desist from all public celebration. The Germans did soften on this stance somewhat as the fair approached, and at least agreed to lead a feast on the day designated German Day. This monster barbecue included the meat of a 400-pound beef cow that had been slowly and carefully cooked over a period of days throughout the fair. And even this was not enough to satisfy the hungry throngs, according to newspaper accounts. Again, I know the feeling. An ambitious musical comedy inspired by and titled The Clackamas County Fair was presented for the first time at Shively's Opera House in Oregon City in June of 1913. Ambitious for its stunts, its musical numbers, and especially its cast, which numbered an estimated 300. The play was for the benefit of the Episcopal Church and included many local civic leaders in its cast. Credible work was done by all, and the play was enthusiastically received, a critic later wrote. The production was under the direction of Annie Sora Back, assisted by the women of the Episcopal Church and the best local talent. The performance was a picture of the old-time county fair, with its crowds and its farmers and its spilers and its fakers, all with appropriate dialogue and sketches, interspersed with the most attractive choruses, dances, and specialities. Dairy was again a central feature of the fair that year, though thankfully the phantom milker did not again show his face. A demonstration of milk and cream testing and a general lecture on modern dairying methods was given by the eminent A.O. Hollingsworth. Electric lights also came to the fairgrounds in 1913, allowing fairgoers to party all night just as easily as during the day. German, Oregon City, and Free Barbecue Day was especially popular, with admission that day doubling that of the year before, you don't say. Malala goats were offered as a sacrifice to the barbecue on Friday, designated the Elks Club and Malala Day, and Portland, Eugene, and Eastern Railroad provided transportation to our neighboring town for the festivities. The Northern Pacific Railroad offered a trophy for the best display of products from any one farm, no acreage limit, while the Southern Pacific offered a $50 silver cup for the best cow. We're going to continue to milk this history series for all it's worth, but that's all the time we have today. The rest will have to wait till next time on Can Be Then.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, I'm just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hare. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Cambie, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Cambie in Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. The Can Be Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joyce Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Can Be by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Can Be Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Can Be Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Cambie's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.